Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 12th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Teaching in Africa, You Can Do This, a session presented by Mary Catherine Preuss, number PRM 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Starting out, okay?
Should we
that's the thing. I think I probably need to stand over here, even if it would be nice if I just sit around the table. Excuse me?
There are more microphones, all just right here.
Okay.
They're here.
Oh, well, maybe, yeah, let me get up closer if this one's okay. At least I don't feel quite so isolated. Well, well,
in the right place. I hope it's on. They all seem to point to that one.
Really?
Yes.
Do you think it's okay?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to all of you, and thank you for coming on a Saturday, which is not a day to think of going to school or going to class. How many of you have lived overseas or been overseas for more than just you know, going on a tourist flight to Mexico and back or something? You said you were in South
Africa. Well, I lived overseas as in the Air Force, but
it's okay. Good. And you?
I live in Switzerland.
For
the summer.
Yeah, summer.
Summer.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
No more than 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Yeah. Well, even, yeah, it's enough to get a little more taste than just coming in and staying in a hotel and going out again. I hope that that you can. I would like to hear some experiences from you too, if you have something that I say about our experience, if you have something to add from Africa or from other places that strikes you as being kind of the same thing happening from another place. Jonathan and I have spent 13 years altogether in Africa as seminary teachers. Five of those were in Tanzania, which is East Africa, and that was really long time ago, 64 to 66, right after we were married. Then we went back in 74 to 77 for a 3-year term. And we've been back to visit I once since then, but we have kept up Swahili in contact with Tanzanian people. So it doesn't seem that remote, really. But my more recent experience was 8 years in West Africa, in Nigeria. And that was 90 to 98, so we're 5 years back from that tour. When we were here in the U.S., it was always interesting to see the reactions we got from people about we live in Africa or we're going back to Africa or something like that. The most blunt, I think, ever was that landlady once when I went in to give notice that we were leaving an apartment because we were going, that was when we were going back to Tanzania with our kids, when we had kids. And she said, oh, where are you moving to? And I said, oh, we're going to Africa. And she said, oh, ick. That was her response. And sometimes it was interesting too, there were some people who were almost indignant about our going to Africa. They said, you know, we have so many problems here in this country, and we need people like you that can teach, and you know, why are you going over there? And it's like a sort of a cop-out on the problems of the U.S. to go to another country. And I could understand that feeling a bit. But there were a lot of times, too, when the response was kind of wistful. Oh, I wish I could do that. Our physician, for example, that's been our family doctor for 20-some years, said, I would really love to do something like that, but I can't, is what lies behind it, usually. You can't because of the kind of job that you do or because of family responsibilities and so on. And those are, you know, not everybody can. That's certainly true. But I thought if you have thought about it and thought, oh, that's something I would really like to do, maybe today, to start thinking about it more seriously and think, well, maybe you could for a while, for a short term. There's so many opportunities now to go overseas for a short term. You don't, the old missionary, when I was a kid, we lived next door to missionary furlough houses, and people would be out 7 years and then come back to the U.S. for 1 year. Consequently, the kids were, to me, as odd as could be. They didn't adjust to the U.S. because they had a year to do it, and then they just kind of got into what was going on here, and then they'd leave again. But now there are lots of short-term things, all kinds of agencies, both church and social and government, to go and stay and work in a country for a short time and be able to have that experience. I wanted to talk about why a person might want to do this and why we love doing it. We loved it so much that we kept going back for more, and we may do so again. We certainly have not ruled that out. And also a little bit about how it is to come back into this culture after being out of the culture for a while. Why you might want to do this. We, all times that we went was under the church. We were missionaries of the ALC first and then ELCA. But I know, especially when the first time we went in the 60s, the term missionary was sort of a dirty word. I mean, the people had the impression of missionaries as being the James Missionaries of Hawaii, you know, and now I think Poisonwood Bible, people maybe have that reinforced, and that, I don't see that as being a bad press for missionaries so much, because the guy in Poisonwood Bible is just wacko from the start. You know that. So, and we didn't run into too many people that were certifiable. when we were over there. But I know when we first went, I sort of felt like I would always say, well, we're going to Africa to teach. Yes, we'll be under the church. But I didn't like to use the word missionary. But it was really interesting to find out when we got there that the Africans don't have that impression of the word missionary at all. Africans are very generous with their expressions of appreciation toward missionaries, too. If you hadn't come, we wouldn't have the gospel, we wouldn't know about Jesus, we wouldn't have our schools, we wouldn't have our hospitals, there were all kinds of things. One of my students in Nigeria said, I wouldn't be alive if the missionaries hadn't come, because Mary Slessor, legendary Scottish young woman who went to Nigeria, was working in his area. This is back in, what's Mary Slessor, is that 18? No, early 1900s maybe?
Late
1800s even. Had the area that she worked in was his area, and they killed twins. If twins were born, mm-hmm. They killed twins because they were thought to be unlucky, and he was a twin. And so he said, I'd be dead if it weren't for the missionaries. But I must admit that I didn't go over there first time with this burning desire to be a missionary, to spread the gospel and so on. Growing up in America, we're very hesitant about the idea of I mustn't impose my beliefs on anybody else, my religious system or my ethics or anything like that. We were grown up really with that ingrained in us. So I guess my motive was, well, I had the sort of immediate motive was that I had gotten really involved with Jonathan. Yeah. And he was determined to go to Africa, which he attributes mainly to sitting reading National Geographics in the attic when he was a little kid. Burning desire to go to Africa. If I wanted to be with him, I had to go too. But I knew I liked living overseas, so that was no big thing for me. But I think my main motive really was impulse to give back all that I'd been given. Being born in America, being born in a home where, you know, I had everything we needed, and being given an excellent education, and having chances to do music and to travel and all this stuff. And I thought, you know, I really owe somebody something. And also to help in a place to do something that I knew I thought I could be a decent teacher, and to do that in a place where there was a great need for teachers was very satisfying. So at first, I think that was a motive for going, but maybe to say, don't worry about it if you don't have some pure and selfless motive for going someplace. I mean, I think it's all right to go for, there are all kinds of reasons why you might go overseas and work for a while. And you're thinking about why you went in the first place, your motive for going back again will probably be different, will change. Why we liked it? Well, if you love your work, if you do that work in Africa, you're going to get to do it 16 hours a day. you're going to get to do your work a lot. You will work hard. But the other thing is, it is nice to do your work, our work of teaching, for example, to concentrate on that and be all the hours that you're putting in working, you're actually doing the thing that you came for, because you don't have this business of long commutes. People live right at the school. This is true of pretty much the seminary is like a college here. And everybody lives there. The classroom buildings are there, the faculty is there, the students are there. So that you are involved in your work pretty much 24 hours a day. You're on the scene, and that can be difficult. You need to get away sometimes. And if you are married, you need to be very good friends with your spouse, to be working with each other 24 hours a day at the same job. But it is really nice to be devoting your time to your teaching or medical work or whatever it would be. Everybody's around there. In a way, it's sort of like holding the school there, because everybody's there. You see people all the time. You can have discussions. I walk over to faculty colleague Eze, who taught African religion, African church history, and his wife had lots of chickens, had a great poultry business going, was a really, really efficient businesswoman and farmer. Go over to get eggs and sit and have an interesting conversation to her about family life and about what their children are doing, what she thinks of the education. Or Eze's around and we end up in a conversation about some African theologian or something. And that's just going to get eggs.
And he had the hymn book memorized.
And he had
the Presbyterian hymn book.
Yeah. He loved hymns too, which I think is interesting for me. And his wife made all my clothes too. And take the material over and she, you know, tell her what you want and she loves it.
How long did it take you to master the language to have these conversations?
In Nigeria, it was all English. Interesting. Yeah. English is the official language of Nigeria. Because Tanzania, Swahili, that took us, we got a very excellent 3-week course in Swahili when we went there, which gave us the whole grammar. And then when we started in teaching, there was an English language section of the school which we taught in at first, but we were, at the end of our second year, we were both teaching in the Swahili division of the school. But it doesn't take very long to get enough language to get around the market or to have sort of an everyday conversation. That with Swahili, I guess, you get in about 3 months or so. In Nigeria, the linguistic situation is different because Nigeria has something like 375 different languages. If you count dialects, variations of those, you get in the 500 something. It has 3 big language groups. North is Hausa speaking, and the center of the country too, really, Hausa speaking. The southwest is Yoruba and the southeast is Igbo. And the people who live in the Hausa speaking section, that they all have a different tribal language, but Hausa will be their language for talking to their neighbors or going to market, or in church services will be in Hausa if there's people from a lot of different towns or different areas coming in. So we learn some Hausa. I speak market Hausa, I say. I can get along the market, but all our dealings with people at the school were in English, because the school is from primary on nursery school even, are English, because English was made the official language of Nigeria, because they didn't have one dominant language that was understood all over the country, and the Hausas don't want to learn Yoruba, and the Yorubas won't learn Igbo, and the English, they couldn't make one of those languages the official language. Tanzania was lucky, because Swahili was already a sort of hybrid language of from the commerce with Arabs along the coast in Zanzibar and Arab Peninsula, lots of traders coming across. And the people on the coast were detribalized. They were various tribal groups that had settled along the coast for trade and so on. And Swahili was a language that grew up about 13th, 14th century. And so there is even a literature in it, goes back. But that, and Tanzania was lucky. It has probably 120 tribes that are representing different language groups, but no one great big tribe or two great big tribes, like is the situation in other countries, so that everybody could sort of agree for Swahili to be the official language. Students, we also had the students there, and that was the source both of good and bad in a way, because, and here was one culture difference that we soon discovered, and even was different between Tanzania and Nigeria. In Nigeria, the students felt free to come any time of day, just come over to your house, knock on the door, come in, greet you, sit down and chat. And the rule of hospitality in Africa being about the strongest rule there is, it trumps everything else. So I have 3 lectures tomorrow, and I've got a stack of 50 degree papers to correct. And this, a couple students have come over just to pass the time of day. And am I going to be the ugly American and say, really, I just don't have time to talk to you now? Or am I going to talk to them and not be ready for, or stay up half the night trying to get my classes ready for tomorrow? And Africans, I think, honestly do not understand the concept of privacy as a thing that a person would want. They absolutely can't understand that anybody would ever want to be alone. Well, why would you? You'd be lonely. And this idea that a person is only a human being in community, that they're you're nobody if you're on your own. So they don't at all have this idea of individualistic personal independence. They can be very individualistic in an entrepreneurial sense. In Nigeria, they do have that. But this, they couldn't understand why we would ever want to be alone in our house. We might be lonesome, so they're going to get over a pretest. We were kind of relieved to find that about the 4th year we were there, this came up at a faculty meeting one time. About half the faculty were Nigerians and half expats from various places. And one of the Nigerian faculty members brought this up. We didn't know what to do about students coming and sitting in our house, large groups of students all the time. We were not getting time to do our work for school. So the Nigerians were even feeling that conflict. And we tried the idea of office hour, we had a little sign out on our door, please come to see us between the hours of 4 and 6 or something like that. It kind of worked, not real well. But then the time when we really, there were times when that was just a wonderful thing. We
were in a terrible car accident, and when we, it was out in the western part of the country, when we got, or eastern part of the country, when we got back, really, this was an awful thing to have gone through. We were not hurt, but it was a terrible thing anyway. And students would come the first few days after we got back. A group of four or five students would come in and just come in and sit down and sit there with us. And they sometimes they would say, "We're, you know, there would be a group of Presbyterian students or a group of Lutheran students or a group of Anglicans or something." And sometimes they'd say, "You know, the talk is sort of they were representing this group of students," but sometimes just themselves. And sometimes they would say, "We'd like to pray with you. We're awfully glad that you got back safely." Some of them said, "If this accident had happened in my part of the country, you would have been burned up inside your car," which was kind of hair-raising to hear. So they were very glad to see us back safely. Or they would pray with us, or they would just sort of comfort us for this that had happened. And just, sometimes they would just come and just sit with us for a while, not say much of anything. And just over and over again, people come in to be with you. And that would happen in any time when anybody, if there was a death in the community, or everybody goes over and just sits in the house and sometimes prays or people start singing. So this communal life can be a difficult thing for an American to get used to, particularly, but also can be a very wonderful thing. A fun thing about teaching in Africa is that you get, or overseas, any place I expect, is you get asked to teach anything that you ever knew anything about, and you also probably get asked to teach something that you know nothing about. I'm a sterling example. We were told before we came to Nigeria that one of us was going to have to teach introductory either sociology or psychology because they had some general knowledge subjects in the seminary that everybody took. While Jonathan had had a couple courses in those, I had had one course in sociology, never had a course in psychology, and I hadn't liked the course in sociology very well. So I thought, well, maybe psychology would be more interesting. He just refused, left it to me. So I taught psychology. But I was much encouraged by the example of William James. You know, he's the brother of Henry James, the novelist. William James was a physician, and the science of psychology was just sort of getting going in Germany. And Harvard University asked William James to start a department of psychology at Harvard. And when I read about this, the book said the first lecture that William James ever heard on psychology was the first one that he gave. So that was one situation, too. I'm probably the only psychology teacher that started with, let's start with what the word psychology means. It's from two Greek words, psyche, logos, what they mean. That's, I don't think, the standard way of approaching psychology, but that's what I knew something about. So, I taught New Testament background, which also, you know, the period in the New Testament, the apocryphal books, that period between the Testaments, I didn't know much of anything about that. But they said, well, if you're a Greek and you're a Greek and Latin specialist, you must know something about this, so you can teach that. And then by extension, Jewish thought, ended up teaching that, which I reread a lot. And I had, in grade school, we were taught singing by solfa, which my husband at the same time was not in his school. I don't know if it was peculiar to my school, but we had to sing everything from a book, starting out do, do, mi, re, re, fa, you know. Here get to Nigeria and find out that their hymn books are written not with staff notation, but with a D, D, M, M, R, R, with solfa syllables written below them. And their choir music, they write that way too. But a lot of the students wanted to learn staff notation, how to read staff notation so that they could get a new tune from the hymn book.
And so I ended up teaching staff notation, but had to know solfa to do that, to explain to them how it transfers, how it works. I'd been in the library club at high school, which was sort of a, it was really a big deal at my high school. Learned something about cataloging, about shelf reading, about what you have to do to keep a library organized. Ended up working in the library a whole lot there. So everything I ever learned, it seems, I got to use and learned a lot in the process. Playing hymns, I'm not a very good keyboard player, but we had a little keyboard, and so I'd play for chapel sometimes. It had a pipe organ stop on it. That was the loudest one, so I'd play for chapel. Didn't have much any experience with that before, so I had to, I had to all the way through sing. They always sang five or six verses of a hymn, and I'd have to say to myself, this is verse five, this is verse five, this is verse five. Otherwise, I could not remember where we were. You learn a lot more than you teach. You learn about Africa. I think the most striking thing, hospitality and absolute generosity of people is just overwhelming. I'm sure you experienced that from South Africa and others. Were you in Africa before? A guest is a blessing. That's the proverb. And that one very much carries over Old Testament. Ash has been talking about all the relationship of culture to the Old Testament. Absolutely. It's just, you can feel like you're living in another time there because of the way people welcome you, not knowing anything about you. They will want to make tea for you or something, and you know that their little bit of tea is going to last for 3 weeks, and they've got six children. But they want to give it to you. Also, the hopefulness. Americans, I think, pretty much regard Africa as a hopeless place. Well, if you meet Africans and talk to Africans, it might be hopeless from our point of view because we're looking at future, what's going to happen with AIDS and all this stuff. But they, living in it, have it almost annoyed me sometimes with the Nigerians, don't you see what you need to do to make the future better and so on, because they really don't think much about the future. But I think that's why they survive in the conditions they do, is because they are eternally optimistic that things are going to get better, and somehow they're going to find enough food for the rest of the month for their family. Somehow they're going to find their school fees to make it through the seminary. And you learn something about living your life from day to day and not worrying about what lies ahead for you. It's very interesting too in teaching to see how your own discipline connects up with Africa and with African thought. People would say to me, "You're teaching Greek in Africa. What use is that at all?" Well, it was a seminary, so it was New Testament Greek for reading the New Testament. But I felt it had a very strong connection with my students' lives, much more than when I teach Greek here, because there are still translation teams going, and these students that graduate from the seminary, if they get back to their home place and people find out they've had Greek, their bishop is sure as anything going to put them on a translation committee. They're working on a New Testament in their little language that only has the Gospel of John or something, and so they need somebody that knows Greek and Hebrew for Old Testament. Also, the connection is so striking. I also taught theology of Augustine. Augustine is about 400 AD. But seeing the similarity of the social situation and the culture of the daily life of the time of Christ, not too different from present-day Nigeria, the time of Augustine, not all that different from present-day Nigeria, there isn't such a big gap as there is here. You know, we teach about Bible time, so that people can imagine the way life was there. Well, in Africa, it's not so different from how it was then. Also, even the political situation, the language situation. In Jesus' time, under Roman occupation, so people spoke Aramaic, probably Jesus and his disciples spoke Aramaic with each other, but would have probably had to know some Greek, because that was, the Greeks had very thoroughly Greekized, Hellenized that part of the world at the time that they were ruling. So Greek was a common language, and the New Testament was written in Greek. But the Romans, the language of government, administration, and so on, another language, still another language. So people were operating in two or three languages all the time. That's true in Africa. All our students, when they were learning Greek, they were learning probably their fifth or sixth language from their second language, from English. So everything that you are teaching or doing is somehow connected with their culture in interesting ways that you don't know until you've been there for a while and seen it. It's a kind of test of yourself, too. I know when people have to go climb Everest or something to test themselves, go on these survival camping trips, or go, I don't know, one of the longest hikes, and we have to stay overnight a few nights, and people have this impulse to sort of test yourself and see what you can do. I think the survivor shows on television striking is just so foolish. Why don't they, you know, get some good out of it? Send five people to teach in a Nigerian village for a year and see who makes it. Or who gets kicked off the island after 3 weeks and says, I can't take this anymore. I mean, why should you see if you can eat ants or something? You could be doing something useful. Then I wanted to say a little bit too about what's it like to come back after being so long out of the culture. An interesting thing that you find out is that culture shock coming back to the U.S. is a lot more violent than the shock of going to Africa, even though the culture is so different. And the first time we went, even, we felt that, well, you expect it to be very different. And you're coming kind of open to learning how people do things, to observing how things are. And so you expect it to be different. And the second time we were in Tanzania, we were three years there without going out of the country. So we came back after 3 years away. And that was a real show. And one of the experiences I remember so vividly is the first time going into a Target store, and you know, a Target like Walmart or huge stores. Walking into one of those a couple days after we got back from 3 years in Tanzania, and I was almost physically ill. All that stuff. I thought, I'm in this Target store, and there are 50 more of these around the city, and in this place, this box, is more stuff than the whole country of Tanzania has. And here are people pulling it off the shelves and paying $100 for stuff they're going to throw away 2 years later, or 2 days later. And it was so, the waste and the overabundance of things. Do you know the VeggieTale? Your kids watch VeggieTales. Remember the Stuff Mart that's being built? We were in Stuff Mart, and that was really hard to get back into that, all that stuff. Coming back from Nigeria this time, we came back almost every year during summer vacation because our kids were here in college, and our parents were getting old. But still, I think one difference like that was a shock, is the growth of the pet industry, which is, I find, it worries me very much. I'm thinking that I'm going to write something about this sometime, but that a Pep Mart now is the size of a Target, and there's one in every mall. People are spending the money and buying stuff for their pets that African children don't have any of this stuff. And is it that people have gotten burnt out with trying to help the poor, so that they turn, and the poor aren't grateful and don't lick your hand and wipe your tails when you give them something. But dogs do, so let's give our attention to taking really good care of our dogs. That worries me about this culture. Just one example. Anybody want to say things or ask questions?
Just a comment that caught my ear about the pet industry, and there are poor folks here, not to the extent as in Africa. But one study showed that all pet food sold in the United States, 25% is consumed by human beings. The need isn't necessarily overseas.
Yeah. Yes. That's certainly true. Yeah. Yes, we're not taking care of our own. That's evident.
Yeah. I have a question, or a couple of questions. But one of them is about the point of view of the people. So when you're there for a long time, did you ever feel that you got the point of view of the citizens of that place, that how they looked at the rest of the world, how they saw themselves in there?
To some extent you do, yeah. You certainly find out how they feel about the rest of the world. And one thing we were very grateful to find out was that they didn't see us as America. They saw us as American people who had come there to work, but recognized that we are not the government, which has been a relief to me in this Iraq business, the lead up to the war in Iraq. Part of what bothered me almost the most about that was having lived overseas, watching America act out every stereotype that Africans, Europeans, anybody else in the world has about America as being bullies, being arrogant, don't listen to anybody else, don't know any foreign languages, don't understand other cultures. We just blazed on ahead, just like that. And you think, oh, why do we have to do that?
Do those people, do you think they feel powerless? Do they feel...
optimistic. But it is a fact that Nigeria, and I think other African countries the same, but maybe Nigeria it's more acute because it's so heavily populated, it's such a big country. Unemployment. There are hardly any good ways, decent ways to make a living in Nigeria. You can train and become a teacher, but your teacher's salary cannot support you. You still have to raise chickens and have a farm, and to pay for your children's school fees. And if you get a job, any kind of job, all your relatives, who are, as Peter Nash said, everybody's your brother that's anyway related to you, they just call brothers and sisters. They're not, you know, particular about degrees of relationship as far as that goes. They see that, oh, so-and-so has a good job. We can't pay our children's school fees. We pack the children off to go live with this relative. So our Nigerian families, professors' families, had sometimes 2, 3, 4 relatives' kids living with them, and they said, we can't support them. They don't send any money for their keep. But, and it's expected, if we turn them away, we are horrible people. We are terrible people, wicked people, if we would not take them. And it's hard for us to, you say, did we come to think like Africans? That is, we just don't think that way. And it's really hard to come to think that way. Jonathan was just talking to somebody last night and quoted Bishop Moshi, Tanzania. Somebody had asked him, do the missionaries that stay here a long time, do they really become Africans? Do they become Tanzanians? And he said, well, you know, a log can lie in the water for a long time, but it never becomes a crocodile. So you do come to understand things, a lot of things that you, and see what the view of America is. That was really interesting to see. But I don't think you would ever quite come to think that way. I don't know, some of the Americans or British people who were married to Africans had gotten a lot farther along in that direction.
The analogy of teaching someone to fish versus giving them a fish. Sometimes aid programs seem like trying to bail the ocean out with a teaspoon.
Yeah.
You feel that you're leveraging your efforts and expanding beyond what you personally can do one-on-one.
Yeah, yeah. Missionaries and other people who work overseas, you know, the ideal is you work yourself out of the job that you are trying to train people there to do that so that it won't be necessary. Nigeria was kind of depressing because when you drove around in the countryside, you'd see this barren savanna country around where we were with big boulder heaps called dunes. It was a very odd landscape today. But a big sky, like Montana, some places look like that. And you'd see just this barren place, nothing on it, rocks and grass. And there'd be a sign, government reforestation project. It's not a tree to be seen. And it, the sign would be old, brainwashed. You could see it had been there for 10 years or something. You know, partially built buildings all over the country. Those are people's houses, but they are also aid projects. Because the economic situation is so bad, aid projects and church projects often run into the situation that it is turned over to nationals and suddenly all the money disappears. Because, and this is, we tend to judge that, you know, talk about how corrupt Nigeria is and so on, which it is, you know. But these small scale things, in Africa, if you are a church treasurer, your wife's sister will die unless she gets a heart operation, or something has got into her eye while she's splitting wood, and unless they operate on it right away, she will be blind. The only money to be had for getting that operation is the church treasury, which you have access to. This happens with aid projects too. Family loyalty and duty to your family trumps everything. Loyalty to an institution, to a project, doesn't carry much weight. So it's very hard to get things going. But we are encouraged in our teaching by the fact that some of my Greek students from TCNN, Theological College of Northern Nigeria, are now faculty members, and our students have gone on and they got a master's from us, and then they've had a chance to study in a little in the US or England or Germany or someplace and come back and are now on the faculty. So we have some feeling that we're replacing ourselves and, you know, that people have taken on the work that we were doing while they didn't have enough people to do it.
on so it gets all right.
It's kind of odd to compare child raising in Nigeria with in this country. But children are dealt with quite sternly, very often by older siblings. The older sister will rule this little flock of little ones with a stick and smack them when she wants to. The teachers are very stern with the kids, harsh it seems to us. You know, they physical punishment for coming late. They have to kneel in the gravel for an hour under the sun, and then they can go to class. They may be beaten with sticks. They're criticized, you know, for their mistakes and told how bad their work is all the time. And African, generally the people that we met in Nigeria are the most confident people that we've ever seen.
Talk about self-image. Yeah.
Self-image.
They are the top of the world, the best student, the best looking.
They think they're great. They really do.
Which shows that somehow we have to build self-esteem and keep telling our children how wonderful they are and how excellent this essay is that is completely misspelled.
We don't understand the psychology of it, but that's what
happens. Something
else
that has to happen. That's
true.
So they don't feel powerless, that's my point. They really don't.
Yeah.
And it is strange because I had a young student and her mother was a psychologist, and I would critique her work and she said, "This is the first time somebody has honestly told me that I'm not doing well." She said, "My mother's theory was that everything I did was wonderful."
You're talking about a U.S. student.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get this. See, I believe there's got to be some other in between, but it is true.
And maybe it has to do with belonging. There's no question that the child has a valuable place. Even if they're rough on the kid, they know who they belong to. They've got all this family around them. Everybody's relating to them all the time. They're never, you know, just left alone, as Mary said before. Maybe that's more important than the encouragement, the words that you say, how wonderful you are, and so forth, and that you actually have a firm place in a family.
We're talking about the unemployment. An alternative is subsistence farming, it sounds like. Is there any evidence of micro industry or indigenous industry of any sort that's being developed here?
Yes. In West Africa, the women, well, I think in East Africa along the coast in particular, the women are the business people often.
Small
business people. Yeah, and they and they're efficient and very hard workers and good at it.
Very fabulous business.
Yeah. A Yoruba woman who lived, we were in the houses speaking part of the country, but the Yorubas are the great artists and musicians and dancers of Nigeria. The famous bronze heads and so on come from the Yoruba area. She did batik and tie-dye, and she was getting old and a little bit lame, but she had girls, I think they were relatives, probably nieces, nephews, in working and helping with doing the actual work of the dyeing. And then she had in the front of her house, there was one room where she just had stacks of material piled up. And we'd go down and, pick out something we liked and take it to Mrs. Aze and have her sew it up. That's how we buy clothes there. But lots of small business going on in that way. Traders, the men are the cloth that sell the machine-made cloth, the bolts of cloth. It's interesting when you're out in small towns, there'll be market day once a week, on Saturday or something,
people will come from miles around, and there are just wooden poles set up. And on Saturday, these are festooned with gorgeous materials, fabrics, and the men take these around and sell them. And then there's a Saturday market here and a Sunday market at this other place, and they pack everything up in bags and probably take an old rattle trap taxi from one place to another and set up. So people do have businesses like that. Anything else you can think of about
Joseph's electronics shop?
Yeah, people who do repairs on computer repair person, if they're any good, they're worth a lot. There's one section of town where people had shops with all building materials, tiles, plumbing pipes, all that kind of stuff, paint. The Igbos are the great traders of Nigeria, and there are Igbo people living up in the northern cities, and these Muslim Christian riots that you hear about are in the northern cities, where it's a really Muslim area. But Christians from the southern part of Nigeria have moved in and are running businesses. And the sad thing is that whenever a riot breaks out, everybody goes for the Igbo stores and loots and kills among the Igbos. So the first thing when we got in with a driver who was going to drive us from the airport, when we first entered Nigeria, drive us down to Jos, where we were going to be. And we were driving through these little towns, and he'd say, oh, that's an Igbo store over there. He said, if you ever go into a town in Nigeria, find out there are no Igbos living there, get out of there. It means it's an impossibly dangerous place, because they will live any place.
What about East Indians? Similarly, are East Indians the traders?
In East Africa, yes. In Tanzania, it was Indians that had the shops and worked in the banks and businesses. Yeah, that's gone back and forth, because at one point they were kind of eased out by the government. In Uganda, they were just downright kicked out.
Do you know why? Because Idi Amin had an East Indian girlfriend, and she spurred him. He kicked every East Indian out of Uganda, and that is the reason.
No, I haven't heard that. I thought it was just sheer greed. Get all of everything.
That's the reason.
Could be.
Makes sense with that.
How do you assess the political leadership in Nigeria?
Currently, Nigeria has a democratically elected president, which has been a rare thing since 1960, when they gained independence. The traditional way of changing governments has been by military coup. And the democratic governments, which have gotten in before, didn't last very long until a military group came in and took over. But the present president, Obasanjo, was president of Nigeria during the Carter administration here. He and Carter got to be friends. But he is a general, has been a general in the army, was now retired. And so when that Nigeria has been saying, every military dictator would say, oh, we're going to have democratic elections. We're just getting everything ready to have democratic elections. Well, getting everything ready would go on year after year after year after year. So all the time we were there was military dictatorship. But 4 days after we left Nigeria, Sonny Abacha died suddenly, apparently after a huge orgy of drinking and all kinds of awful things going on, it seems. He was pocketing all the money of the country and was a real tyrant. Obasanjo, among others, were jailed. Any political opposition put in jails all over the country, so they couldn't get any opposition together. He died. It was a caretaker governor appointed by the parliament, and he said, we really are going to have democratic elections, and he did. To everyone's amazement, he really didn't seem to want to rule that badly. And they did have democratic elections and Obasanjo, well, yeah, Obasanjo won, and he is a Yoruba and is a Christian. Military dictatorships have mostly been Northerners and been Muslims. Now, and before they have not been able to stand for having a Christian ruler and a Southerner. And that's the coups that come from there. But the fact that Obasanjo has been a general, so he knows the army inside and out and has a lot of supporters in the army, I think accounts for the fact that he's been able to stay in office, and they just had a new, he was served a four-year term, and they just had a new election a few months ago, you've maybe seen that, and he was reelected, and the election came off not too badly. There were reports of fraud, but what American is going to say anything about that now? What can we say? So he is in again, and he is really trying to get back all that oil money that's in Swiss bank accounts from the previous dictators and their cohorts. But he has to proceed very slowly and very carefully, because if he gets too many big people too angry with him, he'll be out, or he'll be assassinated. Assassination has been pretty common too. So it's it's uneasy. North-South conflict, because of Christianity and Islam, but also tribal, and Southerners tend to be better educated, and so they get really good jobs because the British were thick on the ground in the southern part of the country, so people got good education in schools. And in the north, the British ruled by indirect rule. They let the Muslim rulers just keep their power on condition that they not quarrel with British rule, and so there wasn't much education in the north. And our students still complain about that, and that this was quite mystifying to us at first, and somebody really complained, who gave a good grade to him just because he's a southerner, because I'm a northerner, and you're discriminating against me. I don't know where you come from. Every Nigerian knows from somebody's name where they come from, but we didn't know that yet. And it was just that the southerners had a better education. Okay. Here's another reason we like being in Africa, is because of the music.
Joe quit and Joe, Roma Mungu, Joe quit and Joe.